Welcome to IHPBA Overtime, the latest addition to the IHPBA podcast family. My name is Julie Allais, and I am the chair of the IHPBA Early Career Group. Before I leave you with your hosts and guests for this episode, I wanted to take a moment to introduce this podcast series. IHPBA Overtime is designed to extend a conversation initiated in the webinars hosted by the Early Career Group of the International IHPBA Association. Whether you're just starting your journey in IHPBA surgery or are well on your way in your surgical career, IHPBA Overtime should be an invaluable resource that offers a global perspective on key topics in the practice of IHPBA surgery. So please join us as we continue the conversation and explore topics that matter most to early career IHPBA surgeons worldwide.
Hi, everyone. So I'm Leanne Cradell. I'm an IHPBA surgeon in Johannesburg, South Africa. And welcome, everybody, to the podcast, which is to answer any burning questions and thoughts that we didn't get to on the European Africa HPB Early Career Roadshow. And I'm going to let my co-host introduce himself from the other end of the Southern Hemisphere.
Welcome all to the Overtime podcast, wherever or whenever you're listening. I'm Sankit Srinivasa, also go by Sunny, HPB surgeon from Auckland, New Zealand.
And then I'm just going to ask our two panelists who were panelists on the webinar to just introduce themselves.
Thanks, Leanne. I'm Rachel Moore. I'm a specialist surgeon based in Johannesburg, Southern Africa. I'm on the panel for my global surgery side, not my HPB side.
Thanks, Rach, for joining us.
Hello, everybody. I am Niki Rashidian. I'm an HPB surgeon from Ghent University Hospital in Belgium, and I'm happy to be with you guys today here.
Just to kind of recap, in the webinar, we had two main topics of discussion, and one was starting robotics and a robotic program, how one goes about that, and then we followed on with global surgery. So I suppose I'm just going to open it up to our two panelists and ask what they kind of thought about anything that struck them from the webinar as things that were interesting or points that we should just discuss a little bit further.
Well, maybe I can start with the robotic. Actually, we had a very nice lecture on how to start a robotic platform from the base. But from what we had in the webinar, actually, basically was a team of the very specialized HPB surgeon doing already a lot of laparoscopic surgery, and then they start the robotic program. Which is actually kind of a best way to go to have HPB open experience, laparoscopy experience, and then combine them and learn the robotic as a tool. I think that's a way to go. But we also had this discussion that if you don't have that much of advanced laparoscopic skill, like advanced HPB surgery skill, maybe we can also consider to do robotic as a step after open with not very advanced skill of laparoscopy by doing more simulation, more training on the robotic platform itself. Well, I think it was a very good example of how you can build up a team, and it's just a teamwork, and it's not only a surgeon that has to be trained, but also the whole team, the anesthesiologist, the nurses, the assistants, everybody has to be trained for developing a robotic program. I don't know if there is any question left from that discussion that we may address, or we can discuss more about that.
Rach, how's your opinion on robotic HPB?
So I think what struck me was two things. Firstly, exactly as Niki said, that team approach, and that you really should have a champion. So enthusiasm's great, but you need to find someone who actually is going to help you champion that. And then secondly, the approach that I think is often taken in medicine, particularly in surgery, that when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that initially you are going to tend to want to do everything with robotic-assisted surgery, but then as you carry on, you refine it down to working out actually where is this tool best used and where is it most effective and where is the training used. So I think it describes the learning curve for anything in surgery.
Sunny, you do some robotic work. Was there anything that struck you?
Yeah, and I'd be really interested to hear both of you, who I think may have slightly varying practices from both of you. You know, because Riccardo Mameo's presentation was really that of an early adopter, Italian unit, very advanced laparoscopy, as you said. And Nikki, your university's world-renowned as well for leading minimally invasive surgery. What was it like for you to, you know, be an early adopter, the number of people you had to convince, etc.?
In Europe, we are kind of lucky that we have also some, at the European level, programs that are supporting robotic, specifically robotic pancreatic surgery, with the team of Mark Besselink and Mo Abu-Hilal, who are doing this LearnBot program. Mm. So how we actually started with the robotic, that we just went to Amsterdam, watched them doing it, and then of course, a lot of simulator training. Then starting also here, we had a program, established program of robotic abdominal wall surgery. So HPB surgeons doing abdominal wall surgery just to get used to the platform, how it works. And then from there, started to do pancreatic surgery robotically. That's how we actually developed the skills. But the robotic surgery is very good because we do have really a good simulator for that. There is a lot on the Da Vinci platform itself. And then there is a lot of also biotissue models developed by the University of Heidelberg is available for research. And they also actually deliver it for training. So I think it's really like a structured training, and then doing simplest procedures that are possible to do robotically at your team, and also having a laparoscopic skills will help go further and develop the skills. But one thing is very interesting for me, everybody kind of convinced of that, the learning curve for robotic surgery is much accessible than laparoscopic surgery, because with training you can get there much faster.
I would agree that the robot is a much higher fidelity analog to open. You can replicate your open operation a bit better, whereas for laparoscopy with straight lines and fixed angles, sometimes you're working in spite of the technology. So it was interesting to hear you reflect that as well.
So I have a selfish question from being far away from Europe and North America, where we don't have established robotic programs, and we're in the process of trying to set one up. And the question is, you know, part of the training is the watching other people and being proctored through your initial cases. So do you guys have any insights on how one goes about that, especially if you're not in a center or a country that's known for its robotic program?
Well, I think I would definitely suggest, if you want to start with the procedure that you're not comfortable doing or haven't seen it, it's really always advisable to go and see in a place that they are doing it in a really established program. It's I don't know how difficult it would be, but I think it's really worth it for everybody who wants to start a new program, especially if we are talking about, for example, doing a Ripple robotically. And if you're not doing it before laparoscopy, maybe if you're doing it laparoscopy, you can adjust it to the thing. But if you want to start from doing open to go to robotic, I think it's really very, very helpful, and you should try to go and see in places that they do. Proctorship is, of course, is a more difficult to have someone coming and proctoring. But I mean, if you think about it, when the people from Netherlands started, they had a proctor coming from North America to Netherlands for, I think, more than a year to establish the program.
Yes, we have the same sorts of geographical limitations as well. I think it's hard to get past that step. Obviously, there's a lot of online resource available. There's sort of it's high impact to go to an established meeting and hear from many experts at once. But I was wondering if you could comment on, this is a leading question, just the value of going to someone's unit and seeing everything else apart from the technical aspects of the operation, the way the team is set up, you know, the conversations that you have with them, what is set up to improve efficiency, etc. Any thoughts on that when you visited Amsterdam?
As you said, it's not only about having the seeing the surgery, because as you said, you can watch the video and it's as much as informative for technical aspect, as you said, but to see the how the team is working, how the system is working, it's absolutely something that I think it's very helpful to do if you're starting the new program.
Leanne, Rachel, I am ignorant of surgery in Africa, such a big continent, but I, in my ignorance, see South Africa as one of the leaders, along with perhaps Egypt, Nigeria, and other places. Where are the places that you would look to for mentorship or support or collegial guidance locally? Or I guess, in the continent, yeah, or regionally?
Sure. So from an academic point of view, there are very few in the South African context. I can't speak for other countries. Leanne may have more insight there. There is University of Cape Town, University of Stellenbosch does have a robot, but the other universities not. Even in the private sector in South Africa, there's not that many robots. And so it really is in its infancy. And so for somebody who's wanting to push those boundaries in South Africa, I think it'd have to be an approach, basically a collaborative approach, but across the board from private to academia to going overseas, like Nikki says, to see it. So you'd really have to be passionate and want to champion it, because it's not something that's just going to fall into your lap.
Yeah, so I think, you know, in terms of the robots that are here in our sort of teaching hospitals per se, I know from speaking to colleagues that where colorectal has been has had a pretty good uptake for robotic work, the uptake for HPB work is a lot slower and a lot less, and in the private sector even more so, in that funders are prepared to accept robotic colorectal work, but not so much a patibulary work. So they're really, when I say we're starting, and within sort of, you know, us at the southern tip and the very northernmost tip, there really is not many any sort of centers which are kind of renowned for their robotic program. So it is very much a case of we would need to travel elsewhere. We have quite a Eurocentric medical system. So for us, Europe is a pretty close kind of approximation of how we work. So that's often where we would head to in terms of getting stuff. Some of my colleagues have got a very close relationship with the Japanese HPB community, so that would probably be another option. But I mean, from a logistical point of view and a financial point of view, it's quite tough. And like I said, it's not really being funded by our public healthcare sector, and to get it funded in the private healthcare sector, equally difficult.
Yeah. And, you know, Rachel, as you know, our viewership and reach through the IHPBA is truly global, even if it seems like there's a lot of North American and European leadership in terms of presentation. So we'll have a lot of people who'll be having similar issues, you know, within at a personal level or institutional level. With your global surge hat on, I'd be very interested to hear your honest opinion whether you think this is this is a worthwhile priority. I know you're not a robotic HPB surgeon, but you probably have a more global view of things in terms of issues facing surgeons.
So if we're going to talk global south, I think that where we are now in 2024, for a lot of countries, robotic surgery is a stretch too far. We're talking some countries that are still battling to get laparoscopic surgery established. And so to then go and try and sell, you know, the pipe dream of robotic surgery in such countries, it's just not viable. Mm. I think in countries like South Africa, and obviously we're not the only one in the global south like that, where we have, you know, a mixed healthcare system. I think, especially in the private sector, there's starting to be a push from the public. So where Leanne talks to, you know, our funders being reluctant, our medical insurers, well, I think the patients are going to start doing the talking for robotic surgery, which will obviously be a powerful ally. I don't think that we should be saying we're never going to do robotic surgery in the global south. We must just put up with it and, you know, accept that we can do what we can do, because then you never stretch yourself. Then you accept the status quo. And while it may be completely unrealistic in the next 5 years, I don't think that we should be killing dreams of young surgeons who actually are fascinated by this technology. And I think that what counts in the favor of the early career surgeons is the fact that the surgical mindset is so emphatic as to, no, we need this. This is good for our patients. So let's do it. And for me, kind of the proof of that is the early uptake of robotic surgery was obviously the urologists. Now, I don't think, and I know this is a complete stereotype, I don't think anybody ever thinks of urologists as being particularly aggressive, dogmatic, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, go out and completely street fight to get their way. That, in my experience, that's not how urologists are. And like I said, it's generalization. However, they stuck at it. They plugged away. They proved the benefit. And now it's accepted that, you know, robotic prostatectomy is actually the gold standard. And so I really do think that even in the global south, that where there's a will, there's a way. But it's going to have to be balanced, obviously, against what's going on in the countries and actually where is the need as far as your population demographics, you know, which robotic surgery actually is going to give the most benefit. And so, again, it's not a simple thing. It's complex. But I do still think it's possible. You just have to be prepared to go for the long haul.
Yeah, if I can say, I think, you know, countries where there isn't perhaps huge amounts of resources are often a rich source of innovation. And, you know, making things, South Africans have a saying of we make a plan. And we also say that in our state sector, there's no such thing as single use. So, you know, I think that also challenges boundaries on what might be an ideal setup in a North American sort of setting can be adjusted sometimes to work in a less resourced setting. I think you don't always have to try and emulate the way that they do things at the pinnacle of healthcare. I think you can try and see what works for you.
Any thoughts, Nikki?
Well, I think all that have been said, of course, true, and the resources are limited. But what I would probably add to that, maybe we can also try to, at least at the beginning of starting a robotic program, to put some impression on doing the simple procedures like a small wedge resection of the liver, a small, extended cholecystectomy, or some procedures that we think it's straightforward to do either laparoscopic or robotic. We can start with that and then gradually build on the experience that how to go forward.
Sunny, I'm also just going to throw in there that, again, this may or may not be viable, but if you're looking at how the technology is advanced, and obviously Global North are all buying the latest and greatest robot, what happens to the older models that are actually still functional, but the technology's moved on? And so everyone must have the new. Like, what happens to the old ones? And that, I think, is where, you know, Global North universities and healthcare systems can come into play as far as advocacy goes, putting pressure on industry, because I don't know if there is such thing as a robotic graveyard, but where do these machines go? And could they actually be repurposed, zhuzhed up a bit, and then used in the Global South? It's that kind of out-of-the-box thinking that, like Leanne says, is when you don't have any resources, you find a workaround.
Yeah. Fascinating question. That I believe the word that was used for us was it's been decommissioned. And I think it's probably not dissimilar, speaking well and truly outside my expertise here, it's not that dissimilar to how car batteries are quote-unquote disposed of. There's no specific plan for that as EVs tend to become more popular. You know, my other concern might be a bit strong, but is that surgery becomes technologically driven and training is determined by learning these new skills. You can get worsening inequity in terms of the sort of brain drain of surgical intellectual capital, you know, where your person goes and learns the robotic Whipple and then wants to only work where they can do a robotic Whipple and not necessarily come back to a resource poor environment. We see this on a lower scale, I think, in every country where it's harder for rural settings to recruit very well trained surgeons, or rather super specialized surgeons. Any thoughts on that? Just as, you know, laparoscopy becomes, I guess, not replaced, but complemented by the robot, adding another layer of technological complexity.
Yeah, so I think Sunny, because you also went away to do some time. We were in the same center, just overlapping. But I think it is one of the things, like, if you are going to go overseas to learn a new technique or a new skill, part of that has to be a drive that you in some way believe you can implement it at home, and kind of, you know, bring everyone up with you. I think that's quite difficult when it comes to such a technology driven skill and like robotic work. But I think, you know, like we were talking about how teams work, how a robotic team works, and that kind of thing. And, you know, how we were talking about on the webinar about how it's each person knowing their roles and having that very defined role. I think that's a very useful thing to bring back to any setting.
Yeah, it's like you say, it's a big philosophical question, and I don't think there is a good answer to it, because, you know, you can't hit the pause button even if you wanted to on technological advance. That's just not an option in today's world. You know, it would be great to say that, you know, in the Global North, where it's all great resources, that it's going to become saturated and you're not going to have space for all the people who want to do robotic surgery. But I don't think that's true. So the reasons that people relocate, sure, there'll be a pull, for example, that I want to be in a center that I can do the technologically advanced procedures. But generally, the motivation is more than that. Mm. And again, as much as I would love to believe that a group of committed healthcare professionals would be able to kind of change that as far as the societal thing goes, it's just not true. So then again, the emphasis then becomes, you know, on the resource countries and societies such as IHPBA to be advocating, so that the iniquities or the inequities are not as pronounced, and that there needs to be in the forefront of professional societies' minds, you know, that they're, you know, it's not that they're giving back the social kind of justice thing, but it's just looking at healthcare across the planet, and how do we actually balance that, and what are our responsibilities as a professional society of healthcare professionals?
I think that's quite a good segue, Rachel, into, you know, the other topic that we discussed in the webinar, which is global surgery. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on points that were raised in the webinar?
I think it was a great presentation by the speaker, that just basically laying out quite neatly that it's possible, but these are the challenges you're going to face, and not trying to paint a rosy picture of how wonderful and how easy collaborative research is in any space, but obviously in the surgical space as well. But again, that it's doable, that it's possible. Where there's a will, there's a way. And I think the great thing about being in 2024 as an early career surgeon is that there's already a lot of established, well-established collaborative networks for surgical research. So you don't have to go out and invent the wheel. You can tap into work that's going on internationally. And I think, you know, it used to be a lone voice in the wilderness, and you'll probably recall in the literature, there were screeds written about how terrible collaborative research is and about how it doesn't prove anything. And, you know, which came from the diehard old school, this is how we do it, and there is no better way to do it. But I think, you know, that has well and truly been debunked. And so now, you know, it's a really exciting space. And yeah, I think that for me is the big thing, that it's not easy, but it's doable and there's lots of opportunities.
What I quite like about collaborative research is, even in one topic, it often shows you that there's more than one way to skin a cat. So, you know, the topic would suggest there's a degree of sameness, but when you go, you know, particularly worldwide or continent wide, you find that there's a lot of different approaches to obtain good outcomes.
Absolutely. And also the spin-offs that then come out. So obviously the collaborative will have set whatever research topic and gathered the data and put out the publication. But then the spin-offs from that and the data mining that is then possible, because you've got this massive data set. And for me, the exciting thing about collaborative research, particularly the global surge group, obviously was international, but then out of that came the NIHR research, a global research unit on global surgery. And that was specifically for Global South. And one of my big bugbears as a healthcare professional, as a surgeon, was that a lot of the research was always generated in the Global North. And then you almost expect it to copy and paste into your setting. Mm-hmm. Whereas we know that that actually doesn't work. And so to be generating research from regions and localities that are much more similar to your home locality, it suddenly makes sense. And then the research questions that you've had, you can potentially then piggyback onto that data set if you're part of the collaborative, and then you do your own kind of side studies or side data mining on the side, which for me is really, really exciting because, like you said, opens up a world of possibilities.
I was just wondering, Nikki, because I mean, I think, you know, Johannesburg, we've had the global surgery hub under Rachel and stuff for a while, so it's very much on our radar. How much on the radar is it in somewhere like Ghent?
Well, I should say, actually, I'm not sure that we are very much involved in the research of that. So, unfortunately, I would say I found it a bit, especially in Belgium, doing this kind of collaborative research, maybe a bit more difficult than doing the research in other countries, because the regulation for ethical committee is really like way more difficult than at least what I used to before doing it, especially now with this GDPR thing. Everything is becoming much more complex and complicated, that if you want to do a multicentric study, if you want to be part of this kind of collaborating team, is really a lot of paperwork before you can include one patient data to that. So I think that's maybe something that is different from other countries that are contributing more in this kind of research.
So I'd just like to speak to that point, Nikki, because you're absolutely right as to how difficult it is, but it's the same in most countries because, and South Africa, obviously I can only speak from my experience, but just because of our past, our historical past, and how the healthcare professions were often implicit in our whole apartheid history, is that our research ethical standards are probably the most robust in the world, definitely right up there. And absolutely, the hoops that I had to jump through in order to get things going, incredibly frustrating, but it's exactly, you know, as anything for the first time or the second time or the third time, it's that groundbreaking that's incredibly hard work. But once you've kind of paved the way, then those that come behind you, it's a little easier. And so it was not an easy process. We were fortunate in that our university actually had almost an administrative arm set up that can actually, you can run the studies through, which helped. But I think anything in the first time is going to be hard. And it's also, unfortunately, about convincing universities that it's okay to work with other universities, because there's often very much that kind of outward looking suspicion that you can trust your own people, but once you start talking outside, and so, you know, data sharing across borders and all of those little complexities, I really wouldn't want anybody to think that it's going to be easy. But I would keep reinforcing that, like you say, it's worth it.
Absolutely true. Fully agree. I think we just, every actually valuable thing is difficult.
Do you think that the research collaborators have allowed a number of places to overcome geographical isolation? Because you can see, you know, North America often stands on its own, and Europe also has so many countries in close approximation. For example, Ghent University publishes a number of multicentric things on experience in minimally invasive surgery. It's one field I'm familiar with. I'm sure there's more. But for, you know, for other people, myself in this situation, you know, our unit's part of Paranoia, Gecko, and a few others, these collaborators have really allowed us to overcome our, you know, geography.
Absolutely. It suddenly, well, not suddenly, because it takes a little while to get there, but once it's in place, it really is a powerful force for good in connecting surgical communities, in that, and I mean, that does obviously speak to the way the world has gone, that the global village concept, but from a research point of view, I think you're absolutely correct that it was easy to become quite isolated, and this is what we do in our center, and maybe you kind of reach out to the areas around you, whereas this, the big collaborative research allows you to connect across the globe, and I think allows you to feel that actually you are part of this, that you are part of a surgical research community, which is really important, because traditionally research is a lonely business. Is you had a fire burning in you, you wanted to do this, so you got on and did it, but nobody really understood, and nobody understood how hard it was, but you kept doing it and eventually came to some kind of conclusion, whereas this allows people to feel connected. And so in that, it's really powerful, because it's still hard, but, you know, you're slugging away in the research trenches together. And I think that really, really is powerful, and something that we don't always recognize.
So I was going to say, I think that speaks a little bit to kind of like what Sunny's saying and what you're saying, Rachel, is the democratization of research in terms of, you know, especially like if you look at the studies that have been done, they're not these super robotic Whipple versus laparoscopic Whipple surgeries. It's everyday surgeries that are part of, you know, everyday practice for general surgeons. So it makes your sort of everyday work relevant. But I think what I've noticed is also the accessibility of research to sort of our younger members of staff. And I'm thinking here specifically of things like medical students, registrars. I think in Europe and even in the US, there's very much a culture of medical students becoming involved in research and papers and publishing and that kind of thing, which has not traditionally been something that's been within the sort of reach of our students even. And now with these studies that are attainable for younger
members of the community, the surgical community, to access and contribute and feel that they have a worthy contribution, I think is also helped with, you know, that isolation of, you know, of what you're doing and where you're doing it.
My question's a bit simpler. Have you found that you've made a number of friends from around the world? Something that I quite enjoy about from academia is just you get to know people that are living lives very similar to you, albeit in different countries.
Absolutely. It's kind of like, you know, going to a conference, surgical conference, meeting people, you have the connection, but then for the conference, you go back to your own places. Whereas with collaborative research, you stay in touch because you are bouncing things off each other, you're working towards the same goal, and then you make a plan to actually stay connected to those people. So absolutely, it is one of the joys of meeting people that you would never meet before, but that it's easier to maintain that connection because of the ongoing collaboration and research.
So I think we've had a really good kind of chat and conversation, and I think some really nice points have built on what was said in the webinar.
Thank you for your time. It's been fascinating to get these two topics together. You're a truly global perspective.
Thank you so much, everyone. Actually, it was also an honor and pleasure to be here and talk to you and get to know you. And hopefully we meet also in South Africa soon.
Yeah, and thank you for hosting. Thank you for inviting us. And even though it may have seemed a little odd, I think putting those two topics together was a stroke of genius, because it really did spark a whole lot of conversation and realize that actually the two can coexist in 2024. So thank you.